Welcome to the Someone to Tell It To podcast. Our guest today was just wonderful. She has a sense of compassion and care for the animals that she treats and for the families who love those animals, those pets. And we've never had a guest who is a veterinarian before. And to have her speak about the work that she does and how closely it affects and includes human care is really important. And so we hope that you will enjoy this conversation that we had and, the things that we talked about. And we hope that you'll learn and how what pets can do for our lives, how they can impact us and give us things that sometimes humans don't. So we're grateful to have had this conversation, and we're grateful that you joined us in it today.
So I'd like to just tell us all a little bit about our guest. Our guest today is Doctor of Veterinary Medicine, Leah Belanger, who practices with her husband, Dr. Glenn Book, in Middletown, Pennsylvania, not far from Someone to Tell It To's office. Dr. Belanger attended Cornell University, where she obtained both her Bachelor of Science degree in Animal Science and her Doctorate of Veterinary Medicine. She has spent her career in small animal family practice and enjoys being able to play a part in helping people to enjoy meaningful relationships with animals. She lives with her husband on his family's farm and has two adult sons. As you might expect, she lives among a variety of critters. What you might not expect is that she enjoys spinning and knitting the wool from the sheep her family raises.
Dr. Belanger, welcome to the Someone to Tell It To podcast. We're really glad to meet you and to have you here with us today.
Well, thank you so much. It's a nice opportunity, and I hope we're going to have a fun time today.
We will. We have no doubt. Mm-hmm. What we're going to do is ask you the question that we try to ask all of our guests, the first one, and it's a very open-ended one. You can say whatever you'd like. Please just tell us about yourself.
Well, I am a daughter and a sister and a wife and a mother and a veterinarian and a citizen in my community. And I try to take all of those roles seriously, give them the attention that they deserve. Sometimes one of those roles requires more attention than the others. I think that's part of life. But I enjoy each of those roles and having that time. I will say that I have learned over the years that I'm a bit of an introvert, which I have come to accept about myself, and I am an absolutely unrepentant chocoholic. So dark chocolate anytime, bring it on.
Well,
you live in the right
there's
area.
Some synergy here.
Yes.
Because we both are introverts as well, even though we kind of have extroverted jobs, but we naturally are more introverted. I love chocolate too. Tom has a little bit more problem with it just because it doesn't always sit well in his body.
I'm sorry.
No, it's painful.
I live in Hershey, so I have to like chocolate.
And it smells like chocolate some days when you're
some days, some town. Days it does.
Lovely.
Yeah. So thank you.
And so you're a graduate of Cornell.
I did.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit more about that.
I loved my time in upstate New York. That was really, really beautiful there. I think my undergraduate degree is in animal science, and then I stayed there for veterinary school. And I think it's kind of unusual for someone my age to still be working in the field that their degree was in. Mm. And it's interesting because we often have students coming through who are there for some sort of a job shadowing kind of a career day program. And one of the questions that they always are supposed to ask us is, what advice would you have for someone in my situation? And the advice that I always give them is keep your options open, because you never know what direction your life is going to take you in. And I will encourage these students to ask the next 10 adults that you meet, what do you do for a living now? And what did you think you would be doing when you were in high school? And I always tell them, you'll be astonished at how different that is for most of the people that you talk to. Mm-hmm. So I think I'm kind of an outlier, and that's the same for me. But I think for a lot of folks, it is.
So did you know as a child you wanted to be a vet?
I think so, yeah. Wow. Yeah. I was in third grade, and I had a wonderful third grade teacher, Darlene Chasnoff, if you're out there anywhere, thank you. She was fantastic. And she knew that I liked animals. I liked to read, and so still do. And so I was just reading a lot of kind of animal-related books, and she knew that, and she knew that I liked science. And she said, oh, you should be a veterinarian. And I'm sure that was just a toss-off comment that she made, but it stuck. And here I am, 30 years, plus or minus.
I think the research now says that, and I'm right on the cusp of being the last little wave of being a millennial, like you're going to change career paths like 7 times, I think is what the latest research is, which is just very different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's interesting. And a lot of veterinarians will say that, oh, this is what I've always wanted to do, you know, from the time I was very young. And I think that's maybe a little bit unusual just for veterinarians as a group. And certainly there are lots of exceptions to that. But for a lot of us, it's what we've always thought we were going to be doing and what we've always wanted to be doing.
Do you have any theories as to why that is the case, why veterinarians might be more outliers when it comes to this?
I don't know that I can answer that, but I will say that there's not a lot of routes to get there. You know, it's professional school and it's hard to get to later in life just because of the amount of education and time that goes into the training, that you kind of have to be focused on that from the start.
Well, tell us, what is it? Tell us about the educational process, what it does take to be a veterinarian.
Well, after high school, there's a requirement for at least some college education. It's possible to start veterinary school without actually having an undergraduate degree, but practically speaking, you have an undergraduate degree first, then it's the application to professional school, which is another 4 years of training. And at that point, then there's board exams to pass and licensing exams. And at that point, you're eligible to go into practice, which is what I did. Some of my colleagues will go on from there or did go on from there and do an internship and a residency and will become a board certified specialist in kind of any field you can think of, anything that there's an ologist for. We have in veterinary medicine too. So we send patients to see the dermatologist and the cardiologist and the oncologist and the surgeon and the radiologist or whatever else needs to be done if the patient has a need that is beyond what we can accommodate in general practice.
Your husband's also a veterinarian. Did you meet in school?
We did.
We did.
And I swore up and down going in that I was not going to get involved with a classmate. That didn't last very
long. Famous last words, right?
Exactly. So here we are.
So your practice, Londonderry Animal Hospital, is known as a full-service veterinary medical facility. Compassionate and excellent care is something that's very important to you and your team. In fact, it's your highest mission. You're committed to promoting responsible pet ownership and lifelong health care for your animal patients and their human families. So how do those values manifest themselves in how you treat your patients and their families who bring them to you for their care? And what does compassionate and excellent care look like to you?
Yeah, that's a question with a lot of moving parts too. Our slogan is your other family doctor, if you will. And I think that is kind of at the heart of what we do. And we're not caring just for the animal patient, but also for the rest of the family, the human family, and also kind of the community along with it. And that kind of goes back to a concept which is not new at all, but is getting more attention and we're talking about it more. And it's the idea of one health. And that is that human health and animal health and the health of our planet is all very much tied together. And we need to think about that with everything that we do. And so to provide excellent care, not only do I need to be up to date with, you know, current technology, current treatments, knowing what's new, keeping up with the literature, but also, you know, thinking about the bigger picture. And if I am, for example, and COVID was a great example of this, of the interrelationship between human health and animal health. Mm. Another example would be parasite prevention. And if I'm treating a dog or a cat for parasites, not only am I preventing them from making that animal sick, I'm preventing them from coming into the house, becoming a problem for potentially children in the house, or if there's an elderly person or somebody who's immunocompromised in the house, that's important. And we don't want that. We don't want the animal bringing that into the home. And we don't want them spreading their parasites, whatever they might have, all over the neighborhood and potentially causing problems on a much broader scale. So it's much bigger than just the patient in front of me that I'm dealing with. So I think that's important. And when we're talking about compassion, it will come as no surprise to you. That starts with listening, and it starts with observing, asking open-ended questions, and trying to get at the heart of what's going on, and addressing not just the needs of the animal, but also of their human family. And sometimes those needs are at odds. Sometimes they're not. Usually they're not, but sometimes it's a little more complicated. And being compassionate requires being able to take a step back and consider the question from multiple angles and from multiple perspectives. And I need to meet the needs of not just my patient, but also their family, their physical needs, but also their emotional needs and their social needs.
Is that something you were taught in school, how to do that? Or was that stressed? or was it really just about the medicine and less about the other human emotional aspects?
That is something that has changed, I think, a lot. When I was in school, there was a little bit of conversation in that, but not nearly what there is today. And so my colleagues who are graduating now have had a lot more training in listening and communicating and those kinds of what are sometimes called soft skills. I don't think they're necessarily so soft.
We agree. We agree.
Most of what I have come to understand over the years has come from trial and error and from reading and trying to educate myself. And from trying to put myself in the position of the human client and also the animal patient, how would I want to be treated? Would I want to be my patient if I were in that situation? Is this the kind of care that I would want for myself, for my pet, for my family?
Give you a little historical perspective for our listeners here today. The reason that we are connected with Dr. Leah today was because one of our team members had been visiting you with one of her pets. And when she was out in the parking lot, there was a couple that were very distraught, and she could just tell that they had received some difficult news. And so our team member, being a dynamic listener, went up and just engaged this couple in conversation and just offered some care and simple care and support in the parking lot. But it just was this kind of healing moment for this family. And I think those simple encounters, I'm sure you've had so many of those throughout your career. Are there some that especially stand out to you that you just can think back and say, I can see how it was a part of this larger One Health, I think is what you called it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think just being able to be in the moment, whatever that moment happens to be, is important. When I was a quite new graduate, I was doing a euthanasia for somebody, and it was after hours, and she had come in to be with her pet, and we euthanized the dog and just kind of sat there together on the floor for quite a while. It was could have been easily been half an hour or so, her just kind of telling me stories about her life with this pet. And it was lovely, and I think it was really helpful for her to have that chance to say that. And it was helpful for me to just get that chance to listen and to know that, yeah, we made the right decision, and this woman is enjoying that memory. She's enjoying it now, and she's hopefully going to enjoy it in the future. And it was special. And every euthanasia is a different situation, but that happens a lot. And we'll just spend a little bit of time reminiscing and reflecting, and people will tell me all kinds of stories, which are sometimes funny, sometimes a source of frustration for them. But it's kind of an insight into the relationship that person has had with their pet. And I sometimes it's very rewarding to be able to see that.
Mm-hmm. We know that for most families, when a pet that they whom they love, it has to be euthanized is often very much emotionally, you know, traumatic for them. But what's it like for you when you need to do that, when you have to enter into that and provide that kind of care?
Yeah.
What does that do to you emotionally?
It's hard, and I think it's a balancing act. And at that moment, it's really not about me. It's about what that family needs mm-hmm. at that time. And you were talking about training. There was not a lot of training when I was in school. I always tried to just find for myself and help that person to just be in the moment and to kind of follow the lead of the person. You know, where do they want to go with this? Some people want to just get it over with and be done and out of there. Others want to talk for a while and share experiences. And those are both really valid. And I have to, my job is to just be in the moment and be there for them. And there's often a lot of discussion that happens to get to that point, either that day or sometimes it's been a conversation we've been having in some form or another for weeks or months, depending on how the situation is going. And that's one of the things that's been really meaningful for me, working in a practice and feeling like I have a connection to the community, is that we know a lot of our clients, and I've known a lot of them for many, many years. And so we have that relationship, and I can relate to them on a little bit of a different level because we've been through a lot together, and I have some idea about what their philosophy is and have some idea of what their expectations are.
So by your chosen profession, the animals that live on your farm, and by what you convey to the public, it's obvious that you just love animals. And where did that love come from? And when did you know that veterinary medicine was what you wanted to pursue because of that love?
Well, I think a lot of little girls like horses. I was certainly one of those. And living in the suburbs, that was not really an option. We had a few pets when I was a kid, certainly not the menagerie that I've lived with since then. But I do enjoy that, just the quiet time with an animal. And it seemed like a nice, it's an opportunity for me to be a veterinarian, is an opportunity to use my head and my hands and my heart. And not every profession allows you mm-hmm. to use all three. And that's important. And it all of it happens every day, all of the time.
A little bit earlier, you mentioned that when you were in school, you were not trained or you didn't have classes on maybe the more emotional aspects of the job and how you approach and treat families, you know, who are going through something very emotional with their pet. So, but you also said that you believe that there's more of that now, you know, in schools. So how else has that, what else has changed in, you know, since you were in school and, you know, and what current students might be going through as they train to become veterinarians? You know, how has medicine, or, you know, the theories and everything connected with it, you know, evolved or changed since then?
Well, the biggest change is technology, for sure. When I was a student, if you wanted to take an x-ray, you had to load your piece of film into a cassette in the dark room, and you took your picture, and then you had to carry it back into the dark room, and you had to take out your film in the dark and put it in tanks and set a timer and move it around.
Wow.
And then a little bit later, it got better, and you could actually just put it into a machine, which was an automatic processor, but you still had to wait to get your image. And now we push the button, and within seconds, a beautiful, crystal clear image appears up on the screen. And I can adjust the contrast, and I can zoom in on something that looks interesting that I need to get a closer look at. I can email it to a colleague anywhere in the world with a couple of clicks of a mouse and, you know, get lots of opinions on it instantly. Yeah. And that's a huge big deal. That's has changed a lot. The technology that's a huge part of it.
Sure.
For sure. I think training has changed a bit too. There's a lot more emphasis on the communication aspects of it and just kind of the way in which one goes about solving a problem and figuring out what's going on. we had paper reference books, and your book was as up to date as the publishing, which meant anything that was that we had for reference materials was, you know, several years old at best. And now we can use the internet, and there's lots of information on the internet. We can come back to that later too, I suppose. Some of it is excellent, some of it is less excellent, shall we say, if I can put that diplomatically. But there are lots of sources that are, you know, up to date, current research, and we can, you know, very easily find out, you know, what's new in the field of whatever my question is that day, and make sure that what I'm doing and recommending is current best practice, and not current best practice from 5 or 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. How about pet ownership? How's that changed?
A couple of things. I think people are much more interested in pursuing a higher level of care for their pets, and that's been really rewarding to see. I think society has changed a bit as well, and there's a lot more willingness to accept that relationships with pets are important and meaningful. And, you know, for many people, their pet is their, you know, their closest, dearest friend who they're sharing a life with and having a really meaningful relationship with. And I think it used to be, it's nothing new about people having meaningful relationships with their animals. That's been going on for thousands and thousands of years. But to be able to willingly admit to that and not be afraid that people are going to laugh at you or try to make that less important, I think that's different.
What do you love about your job the most?
The relationships that I've developed with clients over the years, and watching families change and develop. Just this week, I had a client in where she's the grandmother of the family, and she came in with her daughter, who is also a client, and the son or the grandson of the client is somebody that one of my kids knew in school, and we have that background and that shared understanding of where things are, and I know a little bit about their family, and I know, you know, that there's, you know, I know what the other pets are, and I know what other family members are and what they're up to and what kind of, you know, basic lifestyle they lead, and that's helpful for me in being able to work with them. And I very much enjoy working with new puppies and kittens, and not just because they're cute. And to be fair, they are very cute.
Absolutely.
No question about that. But it's an opportunity to have an impact right from the beginning, so we can get things started off on the right footing. We can talk about training and socialization and nutrition and making sure that they have realistic expectations and good sources of information when they need information about how to care for their pet. And that's fun.
Thank you.
We had talked earlier just about how we were connected with you because of one of our team members and meeting this couple in the parking lot. So just kind of a more broad question, what is your approach with pet owners when there is difficult news to share with them about their pet, especially when there's nothing more you can do to heal or prolong a good life?
Honesty and empathy. I think that is, I always try to, you know, really take a step back and say, you know, this is what we know. This is the situation. This is what you can expect moving forward, so that they have a realistic expectation. And you know, we can potentially do X, Y, and Z, and this is what might happen from each of those outcomes. And sometimes people come to me knowing that there's something serious going on and that it may not be what they want to hear. And sometimes it's a surprise what the reality of the situation is. And that's the time when I've learned that I have to just stop and try to see where they're coming from, figure out what questions they have, try to make sure that I'm offering the information that they need in order to make a good decision.
So was that something that you developed over time, or was that something right?
I hope I've developed that over time. That I think that's the hardest thing for anybody in a caring profession, mm-hmm. is to learn how to do that and how to be in the moment with the person that you're dealing with without making it about your own feelings.
It's a really vulnerable thing to do.
Yeah, sometimes. It certainly can be.
You mentioned earlier that for many people, perhaps their pet is their closest friend. Might be a confidant, you know, someone whom hears all the things that other people don't.
And tells nothing.
Exactly, and because they're safe, right. You know, and they're non-judgmental. What are, beyond that, what are the benefits to having pets? How do they enhance our lives? And what would, you know, from your perspective, what would you say?
Well, there's lots of research to suggest that it lowers blood pressure hanging out with a pet. They are wonderful listeners. They don't interrupt. They don't pass judgment. They don't offer unsolicited advice. They often add, I think it's an important structure for a lot of people. I need to do this. I need to go home and walk my dog. It's a chance to go outside and get some fresh air and some exercise. There's just that sense of routine and normalcy. And one of my favorite joke is that, you know, for your human family, the later you are getting home, usually the more upset with you they are. And that's quite the opposite with your pet. The later you are when you get home, the happier they are to see you. they're not angry with you. I've been waiting for 20 minutes and dinner is late. They're just glad that you're there and wanna hang out.
What are some principles that you'd like all pet owners or aspiring pet owners to know when it comes to just having pets?
You need to have good sources of information, reliable sources of information. There's so much misinformation out there right now on the internet. And it's important. And this is true, not just this is for everybody everywhere. I think it's really important to be a good judge of the information sources that you're listening to. Mm-hmm. And a lot of folks come in, sometimes I think, feeling really bad about something that they've done because they heard something, they read something online. And in fact, what they did was completely appropriate and the right decision. But they got led astray by opinions of others that were maybe not necessarily understanding the situation.
When someone loses pet, what are some of the helpful things that people can say, or do you believe we should say, to their family, and what might be some of the most unhelpful things that people can say? maybe that's easier to answer because maybe there are more of those. But
I always start with "I'm sorry." Yeah. I'm sorry for your loss. I know that he or she was a special friend to you, and I hope that special memories can help to bring you comfort and peace. I'm not sure that it's that different from losing some other loved one. That relationship is often pretty similar. And it can be, I don't want to, equally, that's not necessarily a judgment that I can make, but it can be comparably traumatic to have that loss. I will sometimes have clients say to me, I've got this new puppy and I wasn't ready yet, but my family thought I needed a puppy or whatever, a new pet. And that's probably not always helpful. I think it usually turns out okay, but sometimes it doesn't. And that's important to keep in mind. I will stress to folks, the new pet is not a replacement, it's a successor. And the relationship that you have with this new pet is going to be different from the old one. Probably better in some ways, probably not as good in other ways. And it's just, it's a new relationship and you're starting from scratch, and have realistic expectations for how that's going to go. And sometimes it's kind of rough getting through that. And I think because euthanasia is fairly common as the reason why somebody has lost their pet, there's often some guilt or other emotions associated with that. Did I make the right decision? Did I do the right thing? Was it too soon? Was it too late?
Yeah.
And there's a lot of emotional baggage that goes along with that. And I think it's important to just to work through that. And I try to really support people as they work through that. And, you know, when and if the time is right, you'll know it. And if it's not, that's okay too.
Another question that came out of that. Thank you for that. And actually, it's so many of the things that we, again, should be, are not saying to humans,
yeah,
about human loss,
yeah,
as well. I mean, so many of the, yeah, same responses.
It's not just a dog.
That's, yeah, exactly.
What sometimes it, say, oh, well, you can exactly get another one. Yeah. Well, maybe that's a good decision. Maybe it's not.
Yeah. When you believe, when is your professional opinion that a pet should be euthanized, but a family is resistant to that, and you know that the pet is suffering and pain, and that, you know, any further care for them will just be astronomically expensive and difficult, but it might not really enhance nor really prolong a life. How do you approach that when a family is just resistant to the possibility, to the suggestion?
Very gently.
Yeah.
I think it's always helpful to try to just take a step back, and we'll talk a little bit about quality of life. And my suggestion to folks is always, well, think about the 3 or 4 favorite things that your pet really likes to do. For most animals, eating is one of them. Sometimes it isn't. Usually it is. Does he have a favorite sleeping place? Does he have a favorite toy? Is there some sort of a routine that you do together every day that's your thing? And the people who are living with the pet know that much better than I do because they live with them every day. And so I will encourage folks to think about that. You know, think about what are the 3 or 4 favorite things that they really like to do, and is he or she still enjoying at least most of those things, at least most of the time? And that can sometimes get us into that conversation. I have found that a lot of folks need permission to be thinking about that. And I have learned to say, I would support that decision. I think that's the kind and loving thing to do right now. Sometimes we get so engrossed in what can we do that we don't stop and think about what should we do. And those two are not always the same. Mm-hmm. There are certainly lots of times when, for whatever reason, we'll try to prolong life as at the expense potentially of prolonging or improving quality of life. And I've had lots of conversation with people over the years who will relate stories about a human loved one, and they will tell me, oh, gosh, I watched, you know, my mother, my sibling, my, you know, some friend of theirs who had a really horrible experience at the end of their life. And they're often regretting that and feeling bad about that. As a veterinarian, I took an oath to relieve animal suffering. Some other things too, but that was a big part of it. And there are times when it is the kindest, most loving thing that we can do. And I will sometimes say to somebody, you know, we're at a point now where we can't help her to live comfortably, but we can help her to die comfortably. And that can be the last loving thing that you do for your pet. And I hope that that's helpful for folks in that moment to hear that. To have permission to say, yeah, this isn't working and we need to.
I wanted to ask this question. I was just thinking of this. Do you think, like, culturally we're starting to make more, we're giving people more grace around, like, losing a pet? I mean, we had an episode that went live just a few weeks ago on the topic of ambiguous grief, as the author wrote about. And essentially, she was making the point that we suffer all kinds of losses throughout life, and not simply a loss of a loved one. That's a part of some of the losses we will all experience, but also losses of jobs, losses of identity, losses of satisfaction, all kinds of things. And you think culturally we're starting to make more strides in this area of giving people permission to grieve the loss of a pet?
I think so. And I actually know now that there are some employers who are starting to give paid time off bereavement leave for the loss of a pet.
Wow.
I was
wow.
surprised to hear that, but it's out there. I don't think it's terribly widespread, but it's out there.
Fascinating, because many there's still many places that don't give very much time for a human loss,
yeah,
and expect you to just come back right away or be over it and just move on. And So that is fascinating to hear.
Or they give you X number of days depending on what that person's relationship
right.
to you was. And that seems somewhat artificial to me.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I guess we find through our work at Summit of Teltus, just because like you've gone through, let's say, a pretty intense grieving period does not mean 2 years later you're not still grieving the yeah. loss of a loved one or a loss of a pet or a loss of a family member. I mean, it could be anything.
Yeah.
And it's just as important sometimes to acknowledge people suffering 2 years later.
Sure.
As it is right in the moment. Yeah, so we're always interested in that.
Yeah. And for people who now are living with a new pet, a successor pet, it's okay to still be to have happy memories of the previous relationship.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good thing in my opinion to have those good memories from that. It can be really comforting.
One of our team members wanted us to ask you, and I think it's a great question, is what kind of things have you learned about listening to pets?
Well, they usually don't speak to me in literal terms. So.
Yeah.
Although sometimes they do.
Sometimes. We can define listening in a broader
sense. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
The thing about listening to animals is they are terrible liars. Their body language is usually very telling for what they're feeling. And that's I've learned over the years, and I think there's a lot more training in this now, to learn to read that body language and to know what they're saying. I'm not sure that humans are as good at telling being honest with what they're feeling at the time, but animals are terrible liars and their body language does not lie. And when I'm having a consultation with a client, I try to get a history from them first, and it's helpful for me just to hear what their version is of what's going on, but that also gives me a chance to watch the animal just interacting with its human and with me and with the environment. And I can often learn a lot about what's going on just through that observation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And one of our values is noticing. And I think that's what you have to do very much with an animal is to, as well as their families,
absolutely.
Their human families, but because they don't speak, when we talk about listening and noticing people, it's about noticing the unspoken things, mm-hmm. body language, the eye aversion, or whether they're looking at you directly, or just raising their voice, or how they things that are less about the words and more about, emotions and feelings. So what's my question? It's just that you've had to, I think that what you're saying is, you have to just notice a lot that's not spoken because it can't be spoken.
Right.
And you become an expert, undoubtedly, at noticing those things, the nuanced things about animals that actually say a lot in not verbally, but yeah. but convey a lot.
Yeah, and I think a lot of animal body language is misinterpreted by humans as well.
Say more about that.
Mm-hmm. Oh gosh, now I'm on the spot. Well, the probably the best example, and this happens probably every day, is someone will say to me that the dog is limping, and I can see that it's clearly not using full weight on all four of his legs. And the comment that I will get is, well, I don't think it's bothering him because he's not crying or she's not whimpering. So I don't think it's hurting. Well, if they're not putting full weight on it,
it's hurting.
They've got a rock in their shoe or something, which they don't.
It's because
it's sore.
Yeah.
And animals rarely vocalize from pain. Sometimes they do, but the lack of crying, what we would consider to be crying or whining, does not equal I'm feeling good and I'm comfortable. And that is, I think, often eye-opening for folks to stop and think about that and realize that.
Well,
so have you taken your learning from listening to animals and applied it to humans?
Oh, I'd like to say, oh, yes, all the time. I'm not sure that I'm as good at that. My animal interaction skills are probably a little more fine-tuned.
Well, it's very obvious that think we'd agree that it's very obvious that you are an excellent listener, mm-hmm. and using that in the in a broad sense, because it's not just about the words or what you hear from a voice, but looking at, noticing, paying attention to that you have to do that, and just your understandings and insights about how to approach family members about their pets, and you know when you know that there are emotional issues involved, and that, you know, there's grieving and pain from humans because of the circumstances with their animal. You obviously have to be very good at that, and we just want to applaud that.
Thank you for the vote of confidence.
Because the fact that you learned early, even though you weren't necessarily specifically directly trained about some of these things, that you learned early on about paying attention and treating the whole the whole family who is involved with their pet, that is so important. So I just want to applaud that mm-hmm. for you, and the sensitivity and the fact that you, even in your advertising for the work that you do on your website, whatever, you know, you use the word compassionate, and you know, you realize that there does need to be compassion, both for the animals and for their families, and that's really important. That's significant. So we thank you for that.
Well, thank you for saying that. It's interesting that you made that comment about compassion. We have a sign in our break room that says, if your compassion does not include yourself, it's not complete. And that sometimes is hard to, we get so engrossed in trying to take care of everybody else that it can be hard to look at each other. We had the last week, we've had some challenging situations, and it's been important for the team to kind of, you know, talk to each other and have some debriefings about some of that too.
We have some good listeners on our team. If we can
really support
anybody. Yeah, absolutely. So how do you have compassion for yourself in those circumstances?
I'm so good at that necessarily.
Okay.
It's a challenge, and a big challenge right now in the profession is what's been referred to as compassion fatigue. And there's so much going on. The caseload is heavy. Clients sometimes have unrealistic expectations. And some of that comes down onto the veterinary team. And it's hard to just kind of take a step back sometimes and say, this isn't about me. This is about the situation. And to be able to get to a better place than we're sometimes put in. And that's hard. And I will say, this is a topic for another conversation for sure. The suicide rate amongst veterinary professionals is significantly higher than the general population. And I think a lot of that is because we're dealing with death on, you know, sometimes many times a day, very emotionally charged situations sometimes. And it's difficult sometimes to get through that.
Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah. I don't think we necessarily realized that was that so starkly. Thank you.
Yeah.
I know our time's probably winding down, and I did have two more questions, and I hope they're more fun questions for us to answer.
Okay.
One is, have you seen the show All Creatures Great and Small?
Yeah, we've been watching that.
Okay. Do you enjoy it?
I do. And it's funny because I think when I was a kid, that was one of the books that I read more than once. And yeah. I probably most veterinarians will tell you that that was one of their favorite book series when they were growing up. So, yeah.
Yeah. We just
And it's a great example of, you know, being a member of the community and getting to know your clients and, you know, listening and observing and trying to figure out, you know, how can I make this situation better for everyone who has a stake in it.
Yep. Yeah. And then the second one I hope is also fun. I was just thinking that maybe we could all just share like an experience that we've had personally with a pet that really stood out to us at any point in our lives. And I'm happy to start because I am throwing a softball question to myself here. I have some mental health challenges and I'm pretty open about that. And a couple of years ago, I was going through a really difficult time with a family member, and it was on a Saturday morning. We had, at that point, we had a young Aussie puppy, Australian Shepherd puppy. And she had been in the house maybe 8 months, and she was pretty well trained at that point. And I went through this really traumatic event on a Saturday with a family member, and I couldn't do much that afternoon other than just go and kind of curl up in a ball in the bed at our house. And the dog, her name is Noelle. She was a Christmas puppy, came, jumped up on the bed with me and put her head just on my shoulder and just stayed with me for, I want to say, 2 hours. And there were a lot of tears that afternoon, and it was just one of the most remarkable moments for me. They're just like true connection. And then I'll share a second one because it happened in the same bedroom. When I had COVID for the first time and was pre-vaccines, the dog, and that was when they had come out with the research, dogs couldn't carry at that point. And so yeah, I think I'm right on that, right?
There are a few reported cases of COVID in animals, but it's very,
very low. Yeah. So we had read some articles about it. And so I was locked in my bedroom because we had 4 kids and we didn't want to contract it throughout the house. And so the dog came into the bedroom with me. I was kind of my companion for a couple of weeks when I was contracted COVID for the first time. So yeah, it's two memorable moments for me.
Yeah.
Is there a certain story you want me to tell?
Well, that's up to you. Because, how vulnerable you want to be here.
I wonder, who's this question directed to? Okay,
well, you put it in a blog, so.
Yeah, it's out there publicly. I recently wrote a blog. When I was growing up, we had a collie. Her name was Sandy. And I was the one who, I was the one who took care of her most. I was the one who fed her every day, gave her water every day. Took her for walks, brushed her. And every day when I would come home from school, we lived in the country in the woods, and she was lying in our front yard waiting for me. You know, she knew. She obviously couldn't see a clock. She couldn't tell time in the way we can tell time, but she knew the time of day when I would come home, be walking home, and was always there waiting for me. And, you know, and then, you know, would pet her, and she'd just stick by my side, and very close relationship. I had her through it, you know, as a teenager and through college. And when I was 22, I just graduated from college. I think she was about 13. She was really slowing down. There were a lot of, you know, physical issues with her. One Saturday, I needed to move my car in the driveway. My father was going to check under the hood and, you know, and just check out some things. And so I was moving it in front of the garage it just had to move it several yards. It wasn't very far or anything, but Sandy came out of nowhere and walked in front of the car, and I hit her and only moved a few feet, and I fell a thud and got out to see what that was. And it was her, and she didn't die, but she did later. From that. And that was one of the most, that was a very traumatic time. And I guess that's why, you know, I was answering this, some of the, this interview, this conversation, and some of the questions, at least, you know, I'm asking about some of this is probably related to that. How families feel when their pets die. And then talk about guilt, because I caused it. Yeah. I caused her death. And which was a really hard thing to get over for a while, and a memory I'll just probably always have.
Well, and it's clear to me that that's still very traumatic, mm-hmm. to remember that, and I think that's a testament to the love and that relationship that you had with her.
Yeah, she was my confidant, especially as a teenager. You know, going through all the things you go through as a teenager and all the feelings. Yeah. She was the one living creature who was just never judged, always there, always, you know, wagging her tail, always happy to see me, and just never gave me any problems. So yeah, it was a very, very important relationship for me.
Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry that you had to go through that. That's hard.
Yeah.
It's really, really hard. And I don't know that there's not much that anybody else can say other than I'm sorry.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you. Yeah. Appreciate that.
Yeah. And I'm trying to think what I would say I've had lots of pets over the years. The previous dog that we had, I've always thought was just a kind, loving soul. And I had a client say to me at one point, this is my once in a, and this was a gentleman who was probably in his 70s at the time. And he goes, I've had a lot of dogs in my years. And there's, you get one once in a lifetime dog. And this one, he was referring to the dog that he had. This is it. And I thought at the time, yeah, that well, right now I've got my once in a lifetime dog. I think what was really meaningful for me in relationships, this was years ago when I was in school, I was raising service dog puppies. I raised 3 guide dog puppies and 2 service dog puppies for different organizations. And it was always fun to be out in public with them. I loved to be leaving a public place and to overhear somebody say to their companion, I had no idea there was a dog in here. That's that's the greatest compliment to somebody who's raising a service dog. But people would often say to me, well, how can you bear to give them up? And my answer was, well, how can I not give them up? You know, I know how important this relationship is going to be to somebody else. And this is something that I can do. This is my gift to somebody else, to a stranger, to give them the gift of independence and unconditional love and companionship. And that was... It was a very meaningful experience for me.
Yeah.
With animals. And now we have a little small sheep flock, and we've got a set of triplet lambs, and they are so stinking cute.
Wow.
That's all I can say about that. They are adorable.
I'm envisioning a bit of like all creatures great and small on your farm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's not always that idyllic, but but right now it's lambing season, and that's always fun.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today. Your compassion does shine through very, very strongly, mm-hmm. and we appreciate that. That's important to us, and the fact that you show that so easily and well is great. And I can only imagine that anyone who has you as the person who serves their pets must feel very privileged for the work that you do and the care that you give and the compassion that you show. So that's wonderful.
Thank you. And thank you for the work that you do, too.
Thank you. Thank you.
People do need someone to listen, for sure.
Well, thank you so much for joining us in today's conversation. I was just reflecting after we finished of a story that happened here locally to our office in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania region of central Pennsylvania, where we were giving a noon talk to a local civic organization, if you remember, Michael, where we were just talking about this loneliness epidemic that we're addressing through our work here at Someone to Tell It To. And after, during the question and answer time, an elderly man raised his hand and he said, I just absolutely love the work that you're doing at Someone to Tell It To, and I can see tremendous value that you're providing and service that you're providing to people, especially people going through hard times. But I just wanted everyone here to know that the only person or the only creature in my life that provides that for me is my dog. And immediately people in the room chuckled when they first heard his comment. And then there was a heaviness that came over the crowd shortly thereafter. And everybody kind of realized the depth of what this man was describing, that he had received this unconditional love and compassionate listening through his dog. And I'll just never forget that story.
I'll never forget it either. And it was powerful, that moment. And we believe that this conversation we had with the doctor was also very powerful. And there are things that she was able to share and talk about that we didn't know. And we hope that you, again, we learned. We hope that you have too. So once again, we're just so grateful that you joined us. And we want to say that if you do listen to or watch these conversations and you believe that they are important and you believe that the world needs to hear them and that the guests whom we have something important to say, we believe that all of them do. We hope that you'll consider supporting these podcasts. You can go on our website and you know, make a donation, and you can indicate that it's for the podcast. It helps us to be able to do this and to have fine quality technicians who record them and light them and edit them and put them out there so that we and the world and you are able to be part of them too. So we thank you for that, and we look forward to having you join us again when we listen again.